The weakest of all political demands is, give me something to vote for.
I'm occupying Wall Street because if you're not outraged, then you're not paying attention.
Of the economy.
I care deeply about what's happening to the country.
People are losing their homes.
I'm unemployed. I'm homeless.
My retirement literally embezzled.
Corporate banking behemoths rob the American people.
That ain't right, man.
Stand up and say, this is unacceptable and we're not going to take it anymore.
This country needs an enema. Well, the world needs an enema.
Hi, this is Eve Silber, and you are listening to Occupy Wall Street Radio. With me as my guest today is Nathan Schneider. Nathan Schneider has been with the movement before September 17th, 2011. He is an editor of Waging Nonviolence, and he's got two books that are coming out this year by University of California Press. They are, one, Thank You, Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse, and the second one is God in Proof, The Story of a Search from the Ancients to the Internet. He has written about religion, reason, violence for publications including The Nation, New York Times, Harper's, etc., etc. Welcome, Nathan. That's the longest introduction I've ever done for anybody. Thank you for being here.
It's great to be on the show.
I'm wondering, obviously you came to this movement as an interested and engaged party. Do you reflect in these days how this movement has changed you or your life at all?
Yeah, absolutely, hugely. I came to it first in the summer of 2011 because as a writer, a journalist, I was interested in learning how to tell the stories of planning and organizing and building power, not just starting when people hit the streets and the protest signs come out and the marches start, which is when a lot of reporters get on the scene, but during the process of reflection and of agency, when people come into themselves as political actors and discover in themselves the capacity to change the world and start thinking together about how they can do that. That's what initially brought me to the weird little planning process that became Occupy Wall Street. And this movement over the last couple of years has given me so many opportunities to learn and to be transformed and to be challenged by that very process, by that process in so many different contexts, whether it was planning an action, whether it was working through some really difficult challenge, whether it was building a new decision-making structure. There have just been so many opportunities to learn from the brilliant people involved in this
movement. So watching this process unfold in the way it did with all the sorts of people and all the things that happened evolved you as an activist and evolved you as a thinker.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's no going back to whatever you thought before.
Well, I've had to go back a little bit. You mentioned this book, God in Proof, you know, before all of this got started. You know, I was interested in engaging in working, on political issues and on movements. Actually, my first reporting job was with Pacifica Radio when I was in high school.
Oh, great.
Reporting on the protests against the Afghanistan war when that was first getting started.
So you were not new, but you were talking about the part of what you wanted to witness was people for whom this was new and what it took to get them involved and where they would go in their early stages.
Well, when I was doing that coverage for Pacifica in 2001, I went to the protests like every other reporter, you know, you just show up and see, you know, who turns out and what kind of funny costumes they have and all of that sort of stuff. And I really didn't understand what was going on. I was able to report on, you know, this one display, but I didn't understand who was in charge, what these people were thinking, whether this was going to be effective, whether they expected it to be effective in what way. And so I just, you know, I came away from that feeling kind of disempowered, both as a potential activist and mm-hmm. as a storyteller.
So you wouldn't self-identify as an activist at that time. You were still working in a writer mode?
Well, I think I was, I think for both, I wasn't sure where I was, and I'm not sure where I am now, you know.
So let's get back
to that
question.
I'm a human being.
What are the things that have changed for you? What did this experience change in your perspective of this, your field, this battleground of waging nonviolence and the hope of change?
You know, there are just so many different things, and I think it all just starts with being there, with paying attention. Every time I've thrown myself into a process deeply, been there for meeting after meeting after meeting, it's changed me in some way. I mean, if you talk about the debates about violence and nonviolence in this movement, you know, which I was, you know, very interested in, obviously, as you might imagine from the name of our website,
nonviolence.
That discussion just forced me to transform how I articulate what I am doing, how I think about what I'm doing, especially the power dynamics that I'm bringing to the table as a person with the background that I have and trying to articulate things that I thought I wanted to articulate. I was just constantly challenged to reevaluate my position, to see my role in this discussion as it was playing out, rather than simply being an observer, kind of callously watching what was taking place and pretending that I could walk away with some kind of objectivity. You know, I had to realize that I was a participant and that my participation, you know, with my participation, I bore responsibility.
And that came up in a very early meeting, I heard, in a Tompkins Square Park meeting where there were announcements made that there should be no journalists doing their job here. Mm-hmm. And you just stood up and self-identified as a journalist and said, this is what I do. And then what happened?
Well, that was almost within minutes of my arrival at this meeting that I had come to just out of curiosity, sitting around the Hare Krishna tree in Tompkins Square Park in August of 2011. The first thing I had to do was justify my presence there. I think, you know, in some sense with good reason. I mean, this was a group of people that wasn't really sure what it was there for and wasn't really sure who was there and what one another was thinking. And so the idea that they were being watched and that they would be part of a public record, you know, was a little nerve-wracking. And I got up and said that, you know, I report on resistance movements and this is something that I'm interested in and I care about and generally support. And I think maybe they recognized that that my presence would be a good thing.
But it took about a half an hour?
Yeah.
Tell us the story.
I'm not sure if I could chart the exact course of the argument, but you know, there was a group that identified reporters and police as in the same category. Another group said, well, we're in a public space, so, you know, how can we tell anybody that they can't be here? Other people said, well, this is a certain kind of meeting and the media is the enemy and so forth. And, you know, it just kind of an airing of people's different experiences and sometimes traumas. And, you know, and again, that was a growing experience. It forced a recognition that, you know, I would have to kind of work my way into these environments and build trust and recognize that my presence there was not a neutral presence and that my presence also would change the conversation in some way.
The name of your book is Thank You, Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse. Tell us about that title.
Well, the first part of the title, Thank You, Anarchy, is kind of an adaptation from an article that I did for The Nation. And this was in the fall of 2011. It might have come out in early 2012, I don't remember. But it was in the midst of this moment when a lot of people in the mainstream media and politicians and the kind of NGO scene was really annoyed by the fact that Occupy seemed to be run according to these anarchist principles, consensus, autonomy. Where is your leader?
What is your message?
Horizontalism, all of this. And in particular, there was an article in the New York Times that I was responding to But what I was arguing with that was that these ideas, these principles, these ways of operating were really at the core of what was so important about this movement, and that it opened up a space both physically and politically, and a space of imagination that nothing else really could have opened up.
Thank you, anarchy. So give us your definition of anarchy. It's used in many different ways. People refer to themselves as anarchists when I notice they are not. But to you, what does it mean? Thank you, anarchy. You're referring to this horizontal leadership, this, I guess, a sense of autonomy that individuals can have within a group, huh?
Well, I would be a little cautious to pin down a specific definition.
But
I think,
for you, how do you use the word? What does it mean to you?
Well, there, I think, in that title, it means the clearing of a space that is not ruled, that doesn't come with a set of authorities reigning over it, and that enables people to truly create something from the ground up. To build power from themselves, and to build a politics based on their needs rather than on the choices that are offered to them.
Sounds good.
It can be. I think in some ways too, the title has an ironic turn to it too. You know, I think that in a lot of ways, the frustrations in the movement, you know, have come out of people's inability to handle that environment, and so many times over and over, I feel like many of us were reminded of kind of how sick our society is, in that it teaches us to be unable to manage ourselves.
And this opportunity caused us to have a reflection of our society, as we very dysfunctionally worked in this forum.
Absolutely.
You are listening to Occupy Wall Street Radio on WBAI 99.5 FM, New York. This is Eve Silber, and I'm talking with Nathan Schneider. He is an activist and a writer on issues of waging nonviolence, sums it up. Did that website, was that something that started before Occupy?
Yeah, the website started in 2009, and it was just initially a blog that some friends and I created. We were all doing freelance journalism, writing for different publications, and we discovered that we had a shared interest in civil resistance and in popular struggles around the world. We were interested in doing journalism that would reflect a deeper understanding of how these struggles work, especially one with a kind of international perspective, seeing how different struggles might inform other struggles. So we started out just kind of commenting on the news in that light with that interest, and talking to each other. And then gradually more and more people started writing for the site. And just before Occupy got going, we really were able to step it up. And we had just hired some columnists. We had just started being able to pay ourselves a little bit so that we could really devote our energy toward this. And
it survives.
Absolutely.
Was it nourished by the movement?
Hugely, hugely.
Talk about that.
Well, Occupy, I think in some ways above anything else, was a meeting place for people who had some range of common interests, who generally wanted to change the world for the better. And so through this movement, we've met so many people who are interested in writing and contributing, in becoming editors for the site. And we've been incredibly nourished by that. As a result, whenever exciting new campaigns are happening around the country, we usually know somebody involved in them because of Occupy. Not always just Occupy Wall Street in New York, but the connections that have been forged in this movement have been incredibly powerful to us as journalists in trying to understand the new campaigns, whether they be low-wage worker campaigns like at Walmart, or the fast food workers here in New York, or the climate campaigns that are happening all around the country. Again and again, wherever we go, we see occupiers.
Certainly locally, we feel very much how it has thickened the web, is how I like to think of it, that these strands are stronger and that there's more of them, more ways for these people to connect. You probably, like me, interact with people who might say, oh, is Occupy over? I didn't know that was still going on. What kind of conversations do you end up in with people outside of this movement?
Well, it can go in a lot of different directions. I mean, if they're the kind of person who's interested in what President Obama happens to be saying in a given moment, you can just mention the fact that he basically won his re-election on the basis of tarring and feathering Mitt Romney as a one percenter. But, you know, I'm not sure that
you're
matters.
You're saying that you make reference to the fact that Occupy has had an impact
right. That
continues to
That's kind
day.
Of a conversation starter. But
sure. To
me, the much more important conversation is about those thick connections and those webs of connections that I was just talking about among activists, across campaigns, across issues. You know, so many people came into this movement for one reason and came out with a million more reasons. They came in maybe because they were interested in seeing some kind of campaign finance reform or some kind of, you know, modification to the financial system or a lot of other things. And they came out with a much deeper recognition, I hope, of the way in which oppression and inequality and corruption works in this country.
And the way these grievances are connected.
And the way they're connected.
That when you come with one grievance, you can immediately find yourself connected to many others.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What do you encounter as misconceptions that people have about Occupy?
Well, there are so many things. I mean, it depends who you ask. And I have a lot of these conversations all the time. You know, for some people, it's just the misconception that a movement should work over the course of a month, maybe 2 months. History certainly doesn't bear that out. You know, by historical standards, I think Occupy is doing pretty well. It's in a kind of lull moment right now, but it, you know, it had a great start, and whether it continues to be called that, there's incredible momentum and incredible potential for growth. You know, other misconceptions, same stuff we've heard a lot, you know, oh, they were trying to bomb things. You can talk about the nature of the police repression that brought about those kinds of accusations.
Did that surprise you, the police response to these peaceful gatherings?
In some ways, yes, in some ways, no. I was often kind of shocked by the combination of intensity and ineptitude. You know, for instance, I remember having a conversation with a police officer at one point around Zuccotti Park, you know, who was part of this massive presence around it all the time. And she knew all about the riots in London that had been happening a few months before. And she was asking me about that and what I thought about that. But she knew nothing about the indignados in Spain, who, to me, I think were actually the closest antecedent to the culture of Occupy, just based on how the planning meetings went and the influence of the indignados in the planning meetings. So it just struck me that the police had no idea what they were dealing with. They dealt with it, as if it were a militarized, dangerous, violent movement, and they tried to produce that. And in a lot of ways, in the long term, they succeeded.
I always felt that that kind of answer and those kinds of dialogues we had with policemen revealed a policy of education that they were getting, that perhaps London would have been used as an example, and they were not asked to question. They were just simply being trained. I also have the feeling that we were being used as some sort of practice for something. Did you have any of those sensations?
Yes, I had a lot of sensations, and you know, that whole environment, being surrounded by police that way, has a way of triggering a lot of paranoia in one, and I felt a lot of it, and sometimes it seemed perfectly justified when we saw these entrapment cases showing up around the country, when we, as we see more and more evidence of police infiltration, you know, but I often tried to not let my imagination get ahead of me too much. You know, I think, and I just kept my focus on the movement itself, That's always been my focus. Other reporters have done a better job than I have looking at the police. I've tried to do the best job I possibly could looking at the movement. And you'll remember the a common sign at some points, especially kind of low moments, people would hold is, this is just a practice. And so I was thinking, I was seeing that and saying, well, the protesters are thinking of this as a practice for something much bigger too.
Does it matter to you if the word Occupy survives? Do you think it's a useful tool as we move forward?
I'm interested in the conversation about the term Occupy. I think a lot of people have raised very profound and important questions about the problems with that term, the limits of that term, the way in which it, for some communities more than others, it evokes memories that they don't want or need. And you know, especially when we look at the climate movement, for instance, and how it's been taken up so much by indigenous communities, you know, their concern is deoccupying, not occupying.
Right.
So we need their leadership. We all do. And if Occupy as a word is going
to
get in the way of that, you know, I'd rather get rid of it. Yeah. What I'm most interested in is taking every moment as an opportunity for us all to educate each other about how we can build power together. You know, what I want to see is a society in which, rather than people spending quite so much time getting together and talking about what celebrities are doing and what politicians are doing and what this and that kind of corporate PR campaign is doing, that we're talking with each other about how we can build power.
We're occupying our time differently.
We're occupying
like
our time, a totally inert term, use of the term, yeah.
So when I ask you, are you involved in the Occupy movement these days, I would imagine the lines are a little blurry about your activities, that some of them have that word in them and some of them don't.
Absolutely. You know, I've been involved in meetings just this week where that question has come up, and that question's been hotly debated. And some really sometimes painful lines have been drawn, you know, in ways that emerge from the Occupy movement. So whether or not we use that word, you know, where our communities have been shaped by them and by it and by this common experience. And one way or another, we're those of us who were involved were you know, are contending with that. But I think maybe more importantly, actually, is what's going to happen with the people who were not involved. There are a lot more people who weren't involved than
were. I'm interested in them as well.
And yeah, I think that's the bigger question, really.
You were associated with some working groups and organized actions under the umbrella term of Occupy. Do you want to talk about one of your favorite actions and how it went and what it was?
I was kind of a tinkerer. You know, I really put more of my energy into reporting. I saw that as my main contribution, but I did get involved in little ways where I felt like I could be useful, or where I felt simply called to participate. And one example was with this group, Occupy Catholics, a small group of people who were just interested in the overlap between Catholicism and the social justice tradition there and the Occupy movement. And we built a really nice little community, and we did little things like spend the night in on the sidewalk in front of St. Patrick's Cathedral, at which
right.
you were a great help and support.
I was really impressed with your guitar that night. You had a nice vintage Gibson you brought out for that night.
It's a beautiful guitar, and I you know, I learned something from you about solidarity that night. You got on your bike at one point and rode around the neighborhood looking for bathrooms for us. And you know, as I saw you do that, you know, I've seen a lot of kind of high level definitions of what solidarity means, but that's actually probably one of the better ones I've seen in practice.
Well, you know, I like to be practical when we're dealing with how to survive these moments, these nights, these days, these weeks, these months. What advice would you give to anyone who's trying to balance their lives the way you seem to have managed to do? You had a book that was partially written before the movement, and here this year, that book and another one is coming out. What's your secret in that way? Could you share?
I think we have to really work together at building sustainable communities for us and communities that sustain us. What's enabled me to remain productive and continue participation in the movement while also surviving has been the Waging Nonviolence community, has been this group of folks who stick together and we support each other and we help each other do our activism together, and you know, we find a way to raise some money so that we can pay our collective rent. I think that's really important. I think there's also a lot of undiscovered territory in this respect for the movement and for the people who've been involved. For instance, I've been thinking a lot about family lately. I don't think there was nearly enough discussion in the movement about what families might look like, what they could look like, what they need to look like for us to survive the economic conditions we're living through and the revolution that a lot of us want to see. So that, I think, is something I'd like to find a way to explore with people.
Interesting, because families are a place where you see the damage that this world is doing. Nathan Schneider, thank you so much for coming in to Occupy Wall Street Radio. WagingNonviolence.org is a place to keep up on what is happening there. And look for his book. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is Eve Silber, and I want to thank our engineer, Michael G. Haskins, our technical producer, Reggie Johnson. The email address for this show is OccupyWallStreetRadio@gmail.com. You can also find archives of this show and archives of all shows on WBAI at the website, WBAI.org. There you will continue to find an opportunity to donate to the Still Standing Emergency Fund. Do what you can to make sure that this station survives. Thank you for listening. Thanks again, Nathan.
Thank you.
WBAI's environmental show Ecologic is...